iTunes, Black Music Month Interview. The Lost File.
All right, y'all, it's your man Winter. We're getting ready to get down on the Street Official Real Talk podcast with iTunes. And I want to tell you, it's definitely a pleasure. You know, we never get a chance to have enough ladies on this show, especially folks that I consider to come out of that golden era of R&B. And why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? I'm sure the fans are going to have a good time knowing that you're here today.
What's up, everybody? It's your girl, Maya, and I'm back.
That's what we want to talk about. She's back. We got the new single, Lock You Down. And I want to go ahead and ask you some questions real quick, Maya. First thing I want to ask you is about Lock You Down. What's going on with that joint right now?
Lock You Down is the official first single from the Liberation album. It's featuring Lil Wayne. It's a Scott Storch production. You know, we just shot the video a couple weeks ago. We're debuting it today on 106 in Park. And that song is about me being in a state where I am right now. I'm a single woman, and if and when I'm looking for a man, it basically describes the elements that I'm looking for, you know, simplicity, the substance of a relationship. I'm not a high-maintenance chick, you know. It's not just about money and all this extra stuff that you see in the media. It's about what a real relationship is about, and when I find him, I'm going to lock him down. That's what it's about.
Okay, I'm sure my wife will know something about that. You know, I want to ask you, now you said, you know, it's Maya and I'm back, and I want to ask you, where you been?
Oh, I've been many places, been traveling around the world, internationally, performing. I've been in D.C. teaching through my foundation, the Maya Arts and Tech Foundation, which is now in its third year. Been doing a couple movies, covered the last one that I filmed. We just wrapped in March, and it's a Bill Duke film in production. And what else? I'm now on the Seagram's tour. We're wrapping on April 30th, and I've been performing with the Clips. And if you guys want to check out anything or where I might be, you can either go to my MySpace page, which is Maya, MySpace.com, the real Maya, or MayaMaya.com, or SeagramsLive.com. So, yeah, that's a couple of things that have been going on with me, with Maya.
Did you just take some time off from the music business altogether just on purpose? Or, you know, because I'm going to ask you some questions that might, I wouldn't say challenging, but I think everybody right now knows that the music business seems to be a little bit more challenging than it was, say, 10 years ago. A lot of things with technology and the way that the fans are and the music companies are getting a little strange or whatever else. I just want to ask you, did you take time off just for Maya for a while, or was it more or less like, you know, record label issues or what?
Well, I don't always like to put projects out back-to-back so that I don't become oversaturated. I think fans know the difference between what you bring to your music, if it's realistic or, you know, if it's just put together. And I also had to make some transitions in my life with my label, my record company, my managers, my agency, everybody that was around me, even to the place that I lived. I had to make a lot of changes, and that took a lot of time. I was also in a lawsuit for about a year and a half. It took a lot of my time just to get things straight the way I wanted them to be, because if you're not doing it with a passion, you shouldn't do it at all, and that's where I was in my life. I'm not going to do something if I cannot do it my way,
right,
without a passion and without happiness. So now I've been able to do things my way, and that's why it's taken a long time. And you know what? I also have a life outside of just music videos and being a girl on TV. So I like to live a life as well and experience all the pleasures that it has to bring, you know, because you can easily get caught up in just trying to put out projects back to back and miss miss out. And my family is around, is still alive. I had to make some changes and move back home so I could get closer to them. Them being involved in my career puts me in a state of mind where I'm ready to win. You know, before I didn't even want people around me to be around me. And I'm just in a new place in my life where I'm happy with the people that are managing my career. I'm happy with the state of my family, and I couldn't have it any other way. And sometimes that just takes a hiatus and tearing everything apart and building it back up.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, when you make that mention about, you know, the fans, and I'll say this, you didn't say it, but the fans, you know, sometimes get the entertainer and the personal Maya combined in one and think that's all it is. And sometimes we do. Sometimes we all, you know, we do live through our careers, you know, but.
And that's okay.
And it's okay.
I prefer balance.
You know,
I prefer balance.
I agree.
Everything can't just be about you and your life experience. You know, you can bring it to the table, but people don't want to hear it all the time either. You know, they want to be entertained. So I prefer balance. But when I feel like I'm not giving balance or I don't have balance in my life, too much of anything is not healthy for all of us. You know,
that's right.
So,
and this business
is
addictive. You know, I mean, that's one thing you can see about a lot of folks that, you know, the business sucks them in a lot of ways. And, you know, the fans sometimes wonder if artists are going crazy because they didn't come out, or did they do this and do that? And it's not that. Sometimes, like you said, it's just a matter of having a personal connection with people that you might have lost touch with, or maybe just want to stay in contact with, or have relationships with. And, you know, the music business is almost a 24/7 job if you allow it to be. It can be one all day, every day, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I want to ask you, you know, you brought up, you know, Scott Storch on Lock You Down, and I wanted to ask you, you know, what can we expect from the new album that's going to be different, say, from, you know, Mood Ring and you know, your debut album, Maya? What's going to be different on this?
What's going to be different? I think people are going to walk away with a piece of Maya that they've never walked away with before. It's very consistent, and I've been able to create this album without interference. So it's just very consistent because of that. And it's just straightforward as far as my personal experiences are concerned, how I deal with relationships, how I deal with my insecurities, how I deal with a complex that I might have developed through watching my parents and their struggles, my psycho states of mind when I'm going through some downtime or just horrible energy and I want revenge, and then, you know, to a peaceful place, what kind of woman I am in a relationship and how I deal with pain. You know, you're going to get a lot, but you're still going to be entertained. You know, I still have bangers on the album, but there's always something to say on every song without getting too depressing or too personal. But there is one song that is just overly personal, and people can take it how they want it. And I had to put myself out there before I had to go see a psychologist. Wow. And that song is called Riding. So, you know, I'm kind of letting myself out the bag without shame. And I've never done that before.
Oh, boy. Well, I tell you, you know, I can tell you for myself, I'm dying to hear this. And, you know, I mean, because, you know.
I was dying to get it out.
I was going to say, you know, sometimes as adults, you know, I told a friend of mine one day, we were sitting around, we was at this little bar and whatever else, and we sitting there and drinking and talking, and he had this look on his face, and I said, man, what's wrong with you? You look like you're having a stroke or something, man. You know, what's going on with you? And all of a sudden, tears start running down his eyes and stuff, you know. You know, because, you know, folks try to keep things inside so much, we taught to just hold on, be tough, you know, don't talk about nothing. I'm like, man, hey, I got to cuss and do everything else, because if not, something bad going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
If
trust
I don't
me,
let
I've
it out.
My share of therapy, I've had to take myself to boxing classes, to the shooting range, tons of things before I go crazy. You will not find me on a VH1 on the story. In rehab, no. I had to put myself in check and move out of Cali to get myself back together.
Wow.
Like, I will not be that chick. I can't go out like that.
Ooh. Well, I want to ask you, you know, and I consider you, I consider you to be one of the last of the generation that I call from the golden era. You know, when 90s was here, and don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking nobody who came out after the 90s. But realistically, the 90s was a great time for R&B. It was a great time for hip hop, you know, up until Biggie and Pac's death and everything.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, you know, number one, I want to ask you, what do you think has changed since then? You know, when you go back and you think about some of that music, and there was some great 80s and whatever else, and don't get me wrong, I'm not including the 70s because that was just a whole nother era in its own. But for R&B, what we know as modern R&B, I think the 90s was like that peak. And I just want to get your opinion on that.
Oh, hold up, the 80s, so that was me in 90s too, with Jodeci, the early 90s. I got to take it back. But you know what? There's a change every 5 years with the world, with technology. Lots of things have happened with music. You know, it's cheaper to make an album with certain types of artists. And when you're dealing with corporations, they're thinking about the dollar and sometimes not the art.
Right.
You have labels that are signing acts more and more that are independent-based because they know that they'll sell to a certain demographic and they can make an album in 2 weeks and it's not going to cost anything, so the return on their money is going to be much greater with less investment. And that's one of the things that happened, but people have also gotten smarter and on an independent tip, been able to fund their own projects and just put them out. Some of quality, some of not so great quality,
mm-hmm.
and some just demographically based, where it's just you know, a local thing, and it's hot. And I think people have lots of opinions about what hip hop is, what hip hop should be, what music should be. But you have a market for everything, and I think the clubs and party culture is dominating right now. And I think that's South based. And that's also dictating what radio plays, because people have a good time in the clubs and they request certain things on the radio, and that's where DJs are. And if you can get in the clubs, that's usually what radio wants to play. That's kind of what's happened. Technology has also affected the business of music, and it costs much more to make an investment with artist development in creating a training ground for artists. And it just takes much more money, and people are not selling albums as much anymore because fans are not stupid. People are not stupid. And why, in the state of the world right now, am I going to buy an album when gas prices are this, when I need to be investing in my future, when my kids need to go to college, when my son's at war? Music is just an accessory now. It doesn't feel like a necessity. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because of the state of technology and America or the world right now, people have other priorities, and it happens all the time. But you also have lots more artists because of the technology also. So there's just, even with potato chips, you know, and granola bars, there's tons of brands and products for everything, and that's just the way of the world right now.
Yeah.
It's just so much available that lots of things get overlooked, and people can't take that personal as artists. It can definitely play a toll on you emotionally if you're not aware of your surroundings.
This is an exclusive iTunes Black Music Month interview. The Lost File.
Yeah. Yes, sir. What it is? T, this right here is automatic, man. Understand that. See what you know about. Sky Storch got torch. And Weezy F got fire. Yes, and we bringin' back Miss Maya. Yeah.
If I had a dollar for all of the times I thought I found the right one, I'd be a billionaire that I could probably ride out and go and buy the right one. I wouldn't mind a dude that could take my attitude and take the time to listen. Someone that understands when I need a little space and when I need a tip.
Hey, yo, Bruce, turn that up. Yeah. Love is a fine, sweat.
Oh.
Yeah, that's it.
No all-star cast, no scripts, no budget in the
soundtrack of my life.
Just drugs and violence, sex and crying in
the soundtrack of my life.
I'm like Holly and Monsters, Ball Jada.
Just
rap my
All right, y'all, we getting ready to do the Real Talk podcast one more time, and I gotta tell you, it's definitely a pleasure to have probably one of the most creative minds, I believe, in R&B music these days, and I probably shouldn't even put a label on this. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? I'm sure my fans are going to be excited to hear your name.
My name is Macy Gray.
All right, Macy, you know what we want to do. We want to talk about the first thing, the Big album, and we want you to give us a little background on that if you can.
It's a gorgeous album. It was took about two years to make, produced by Will.i.am, Justin Timberlake, Ron Fair, and myself. It features Will, Justin, Fergie, and Natalie Cole. And it's like a whole compilation of all the stuff that has influenced me in my life, and talking about stuff that's going on in my life. And it's very progressive, you know, a lot of fresh beats and you know, melodies that you haven't heard. You know, it's produced really exquisitely. It's a great, great album.
And Macy, when you compare it against some of your, you know, your past albums, I'm just curious, where do you see the growth, and also what do you see that might even be the same?
I think the growth is that I went out this time and I worked with different people, you know, and just trusted other people's ideas and perspectives and, you know, what they had to bring to what I do. And that was like the best thing that could happen to me, because I learned so much, and it just gave me this whole, you know, different little twist on my music, you know, and how I wanted to present myself and what I wanted to say.
And you know, when I go through the new album, you know, I got a few favorites, you know, Ghetto Love and Finally Happy, Strange Behavior, One For Me. And I'm curious, what's one or two of your favorites and why?
Oh, I love all 12 of them, but I listen to Ghetto Love a lot, and I just loved, like, the Will produced that song, and I just love the music on it and the feel of it and the vibe and the way it moves and what it's about, and I just love that whole song, like everything about it.
And you know, Macy, I just want to say, you know, I'm sure for the other producers and songwriters that are working with you, it's got to be somewhat challenging, because it's, you know, it's no big secret to know how creative and sometimes left of center that you may actually come. And I want to ask you, how challenging is that for you to let go of that grip? I know you said you were able to do it, but I just want to know mentally, how was that to, you know, step back for a minute and look in?
Well, it was I started out, we were just going to make the album, just me and Will. And he got really busy, you know, with the P's. And, you know, he got really, really in demand as a producer and just got crazy busy. So I found myself waiting for him, and then he got on the phone and he told me that Justin Timberlake had some ideas for me and wanted to go in the studio. So you know, just playing out of me not wanting to sit around no more, I said, okay, you know. I mean, I would have worked with Justin anyway, but it kind of like was forced on me. I didn't really want to do it from the beginning, but it turned out to be, you know, a really great thing, because after that happened, you know, what I worked, songs we came up with Justin, and I was, you know, totally open, like, you know, who else can I go in with, and it was just a really good learning experience for me, just to be open, you know.
You know, when you think about, you know, the new climate of the music business, do you find it to be challenging to actually put out what you would consider to be your creative force? You know, you got Corpse out here that are, you know, trying to make those stats run and everything else, and I'm wondering, how do you play into that, being, you know, as creative as you are?
That remains to be seen. I mean, it's definitely, we're definitely kind of in a rut musically, where like the same, you know, you hear the same beats and the same kind of melody, and, you know, coming from the same producers over and over again. So, but I think, you know, there are, you know, new artists out there that are doing different things and, you know, striving to be fresh. So I think we have to see how the fans really respond to that and if they really embrace it, because I think that's really like what's bringing down our industry. It's not just, you know, downloading into technology. A lot of it has to do with that. I think music fans are really just getting bored. So I think that, you know, in the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot of change in music, you know, fans really like embracing, and you know, there's, because of technology, you hear a lot of independent records now, so, and you know, those records have a lot of fans now, so I think you're gonna see a big change in what the fans are attracted to over the next couple of years. And so for me, you know, my whole career has been just about like discovery. Like, I have to kind of sit back and wait until the fans, you know, discover what I'm doing. And so I'm this artist that signed to this major label, but my music, you know, is very, you know, its own thing, and could easily be independent, you know.
Right. I definitely understand that. And you know, and I'm going to ask you this. It's a two-part question, but I think I can put this together in one with a statement. You know, I agree with what you said about what's going on with the music business. And I'll say this, you know, and I said it probably about 10 years ago, that it was a dangerous place when I started realizing how many fans were actually beginning to be a part of the music business cycle. And what I mean by that, don't get me wrong, I'm a music fan. But, you know, when you're in the music business, there's a certain expectation that's placed on you, or should be, that you can hear the future, not just hear what's present.
Mm-hmm.
And fans can only hear what's hot now. They don't get the future. You have to tell them what the future is. And I see a lot of folks that are behind the scenes from the business side of things who are waiting for you to create the next thing that's already been out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just want to get your take when you read remarks from your critics, and you know, you hear some of the things that are going on. How do you feel about that statement?
Oh, tremendously, you know, on one level it makes me want to, you know, work harder to make people hear it and get it and love it. And on another level, you know, it's definitely, you know, discouraging, you know, because you, there's so many possibilities in music. I mean, you can do a million things, you know, and it's very hard when, I think our industry shoves, like, you know, one kind of thing down everybody's throat, and then they swallow it, and then that's what they get used to, and then it's hard for them to trust in or hear or see anything else. You know, it's almost a conditioning, you know,
right.
Almost kind of a brainwashing. Like when you turn on the radio and you hear the same song, you know, every 5 minutes, eventually you're singing that song, whether you liked it the first time you heard it or not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like in the industry is competitive in that you want to be that song one day, but at the same time, as an artist, you know, I think a lot of artists get swallowed into that. There's so many, you know, artists out there that have so much to offer, but they get stuck doing that one thing because that's what they think the fans want to hear, and that's definitely what their label is telling them that they can sell, you know. So, and ultimately, the fans miss out on a lot of things, you know. There's a lot of artists out there that you like, but if you could actually hear everything that they could do, you know, I think you'd be shocked, you know. I think that you'd be way more satisfied.
This is an exclusive iTunes Black Music Month interview.
Bet you thought I'd die when you went away. Thought I'd get drunk in my sorrows and just drift away. But things have changed back in the day, begging you to stay. Now I can't wait to see you back and see you leave.
All right, y'all, it's the iTunes Street Official Real Talk Podcast, and we're getting ready to sit down and have a one-on-one with somebody I would say is probably one of the most influential producers and artists of the 20th century. I know that's a big-ass statement, but I saw some other producers' names in a quote bar like that one day, And I'm going to tell you, it's going to be exciting, man. We're going to get a little piece of history. We're going to find out what he's doing as an exec and so on and how he keeps making these hits. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, y'all know what this is. JD, you know what I'm saying? So Def is in the building.
Man, JD, man, I'm telling you, it's funny. You know, just as a week ago, we were going to do this interview and so many things have changed. But we're going to get into something else real quick. And I do want to touch on a couple of topics later on about, you know, what's going on with Virgin and all the rumors and all that stuff. We're going to let you dispel that. But I want to find out, what are you up to these days, man? Because I'm seeing so many credits in just 2006. And I got to tell you, your credits are probably the longest list of credits I've ever seen in reference, other than maybe Quincy Jones or, you know, somebody that's damn near, you know, going to turn 100 tomorrow. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just working, man. You know what I mean? Like, right now, I'm in the studio doing this, finishing this Bow Wow album. It'll be in stores on December 19th. You know what I mean? Right at that iTunes store right there. You can get that. You know what I mean? So I'm just in the studio, man, just trying to continue to stay busy and keep throwing them out here and keep putting the hits up on the board.
Now, Jermaine, you know, I'm sure a lot of folks, man, thank you tremendously, because, you know, aside from some of the other producers, and believe me, I got a lot of favorite producers out there, and a lot of them can make hit records. You make careers. I want to know what separates you from those other producers that are out there. And don't get me wrong, I'm talking about, I mean, you are on that top shelf with everyone I could think of as a producer, but not everyone can do what you do and give them a career. What separates you?
I mean, you know, the difference with me is, from a lot of other producers, I took a different road than a lot of producers. I didn't sit around and try to get on people's albums in the beginning. Like, a lot of producers come in the game trying to sell beats to ready-known artists. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't, mainly because I'm from Atlanta and it was a little rougher road for me. I felt like nobody was going to really even listen to my beats if I sent them out. And I wasn't really into that, just like making beats and sending them out and waiting for people to say, yo, I love your record, or, you know, this, that, and third. I was really kind of confident in the music that I felt like I could make, but so I just said I want to put it on my own artist. That way I ain't got to deal with, I just skipped the rigmarole and just went straight to, let me just put it on my own artist. So, like, the first artist that I ever did was Criss Cross, you know what I'm saying? I just went and made my own group, and we put out Jump, and they sold, like, 8 million records as the first, wow, as a first album, as a first group. And that was, like, my first taste of real success. So from that point, I always thought that was my road. I saw that as my lane. Like, go find another group, you make them from scratch, and you put them out. And the next group was Escape, you know what I'm saying, as a female R&B group, and they sold records, you know what I'm saying. But that was the first group I put on my label,
right?
The R&B group. And then after that, you know, I just kept following my own blueprint, because it has showed proof to me that this was going to be my destiny and my way to go right here, as far as me getting records on other artists. That didn't really start till, like, later on, after I had proven myself with my own artists, where people started saying, well, yo, JD keep making records on these new artists. Let me go over here and get one of them songs from him as an established artist. So that's where that came from. But for the most part, I had started my own, you know, Criss Cross, then Escape, and then came the Brat, you know what I'm saying? And then it was just, like, continuous, like, after one after the other. Like, go find another group and go find somebody else. And then, you know what I mean? Then Lil Jon worked at So Def, and it was like in the beginnings of his whole crunk era and everything. What we did, we put out a record called My Boo by the Ghost Town DJs. We put out, like, this bass, So Def bass all-stars album that was like, that came out of nowhere, but it was like the music that was popping in Atlanta. And we put that out, and that was a gold album, and people was tripping out on that. So it was like every time, the whole thing with So Def was to just keep discovering and putting out new artists.
And what kind of preparation do you guys give to the artists? Because, again, like I'm saying, you guys are making careers. So what do you put into the development of these acts?
I mean, it's 100%. You know, you got to put 100% in, and you take the artist. I mean, me physically, I used to take the artist everywhere I go. I work them, I sell them, I get in front of the cameras with them, I get on the videos with them, most of, you know, and I produce the records. So a lot of times for me, it's 100%, you know what I mean? Like, I did it. Only artist that I ever got a demo from and I put out was Anthony Hamilton. And when I put Anthony Hamilton out, I just liked his, that was a straight fan of his demo. So I was a fan of a new artist whose demo was just incredible to me. He seemed so good that he didn't even need my help. So I put, And I felt that way. So I put his record out as is, and he sold. You know, he became the Anthony Hamilton that everybody knows today. So
I gotta tell you, man. You know, over the years, and I always warn folks, man. I'm an old motherfucker, man. So you know, and this ain't radio. So if you hear something that comes out, man, just ignore me. One of the things I want to tell you, I noticed, you know, there's times where you see your peers, you know, you see folks that are, you know, that you could look at as role models in the game, and you think about it, and it's like, you know, I want to go and achieve that. I see the roadmap to get there. You burn the road up. There is no roadmap to do what you do, you know, and I mean that in a complimentary way, you know, that you've hit something, man, that I'm not saying is unachievable, but damn. You know, some things are just out of reach of a person's goals, in my opinion. You know, and there's only a few people I could say that about. And I want to ask you this. You know, when you go back to your beginning, there were a lot of producers in the game that were, some might have been folks you look up to, some of them might have been folks you work with. But I'm just curious as to how you keep the longevity versus some of the other folks, because times are getting hard for producers out there, but your credits are multiplying.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing about it is that you gotta really understand what it is that you're doing personally. Like, I mean, like I said, you gotta really understand what you're doing. A lot of people don't want to call it luck, but a lot of people have luck streaks, basically. And I don't know which producers have luck streaks. They would have to say, but a lot of producers have a lucky streak where they catch one or two records, and people. The press person might be better than my press person, or somebody else might be better than the next person, and they got the means to put their name out there in the streets a little bit harder than Jermaine Dupri's name was out there, or harder than Timbaland's name. So then you start focusing on that producer as like he the new shit, and then all of a sudden he put out another record, and then you like, well, what happened? What you know what I'm saying? Where's the streak?
Right.
And I mean, you know, it ain't nothing wrong with not having hits either. You know, as a producer, every record you put out, if you get used to every record becoming a hit record, then you definitely will not have a sense for getting better. You know what I mean? I put out so many records that I don't really expect that every song is going to be a hit. I want every song to be a hit, but it ain't enough room. It's only one spot. It's only one number one spot. You know what I'm saying? You can't have two number one records. And like last year was the first time I ever achieved having four records in the top five, where I had number one, number two, number three, number four. And I was trying to get five. I wanted to have every record at the top five to be my song. But at the same time, I wanted all of the songs that was in that list, I wanted them all to be number ones. And, you know, the artist was saying, like, damn, JD, can you call the record label and move one of your records so that this record could go number one? You know what I'm saying? And it was funny because it was the first time it ever happened to me. But I realized that day, like, Jermaine, don't get used to this. You know what I'm saying? Like, you make sure you pay attention to what it is, because this ain't going to continue to happen. You know, you seen where you came from. You might get another number one record in the next 2 months. But, you know, it's hard to achieve what you got going on right now. And I think that's the thing. Like, I never stray away from what I do. You know what I'm saying? I always continue to keep doing the same thing every time I'm in. Like, if I do two established artists, then you best believe in the next 3 months, you're going to see a new artist that I'm putting out that's fresh from scratch. Like, right now I'm doing Bow Wow album that's coming out December 19th. But on December 26th, I got Jontay Austin that's coming out, which is a new artist.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Which is a brand new artist, where, you know, and that's a new so-so deaf artist. So I'm always gonna stick to my program of believing that I gotta put my new artist out.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? That's basically it.
This is an exclusive idea, Black Music Month interview.
Worry about the game. I don't know what you do for me. No, no. It ain't about the play. 'Cause I can't be the one that's the only fool. I was told the true definition of a man was to never cry. Work till you're tired, got to provide. Always be the rock for my fam, protect them by all means.
And give you the things that you need, baby.
Our relationship is suffering, trying to give you what I never had.
You say I don't know how to love you, babe.
Well, I say show me the way.
I keep my feelings deep inside, I shadow them with my pride.
I'm trying desperately, baby, just
teach
work
me
with me.
Show me the way.
This is an exclusive idea. Black Music Month interview. The Lost File.
You know, Bow Wow paid you a great compliment, man, when I interviewed him. I asked him about the relationship between you two. And, you know, he got into business real young. And, you know, at that age, and hell, you can be any age in music business, you know, sometimes things can kind of appear to be one way and be different. He told me, he says, you know, at one point he kind of strayed and he learned a lesson that, you know, you were one of the realest cats that he's ever dealt with. Just in as a whole, not even just in the business, but just as a whole. And he didn't necessarily understand that at one point, you know. I just wanted to make point of that for you. But I want to move into something. I want to talk about Jante Austin. And you give us a background as to why you went after this kid. What did you hear that made you go after him?
Well, it was the same thing that it's just my theory firsthand. It was my theory of, yo, this is so deaf. We don't thrive on new artists. I mean, we don't thrive on old artists. We thrive on finding that new artist that ain't nobody looking at. And the person that I felt like was that person in Atlanta was Jante, because Jante has written. He was writing for Ciara. He wrote Yo for Chris Brown. He wrote, you know what I'm saying, he wrote Be Without You for Mary J. Blige. And I saw everybody coming to Atlanta getting songs from this dude. And I'm like, and when we was cutting the demos, I'm listening to his vocals, and I'm like, damn, these songs sound like, you know what I'm saying, they sound like demos, but they also sound like ready-made records that if you was an artist, yo, these could be hits. Right. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't have my deal at Virgin at the time when me and him first started working together. So, but I knew I was going to get my deal, so I said, yo, when I get my deal, I'm going to sign you as an artist. I like your voice, and I feel like me and you, we making these records. This was like around the same time we was doing Mariah, and I was like, we making these records. And then Mariah records blew up, and we won the Grammy. And me and him wrote a song that got me my first Grammy. After all the records that I ever did, that was the song that got me my first Grammy. So I felt like that same energy that I always felt from Criss Cross and every other artist that I had ever, Jagged Edge, it was the same energy. I felt like, Jermaine, you can't ignore it, because ain't nobody else going to see what you're feeling right now. You know what I'm saying? It's only me and him in the studio at late night hours. It wasn't like it was a demo involved. It was, I believe that I could make you into an artist. What you got right now is a very rough stone, and I can shine it up real good. You know what I'm saying? And that was basically where we went. And, you know, so far, so good. People loving him. People can't wait till his album come out. People love all the songs he's ever written, and the response is really good on Jante. So, and it's a new artist, once again, you know what I'm saying? So I know that when you come out with a new artist, too, it don't matter who you are when bringing a new artist out. See, me as being Jermaine Dupri, I don't look for the new artist to jump right off the shelves because it's Jermaine Dupri. Because I, even as a consumer with me, I wouldn't just go buy an artist just because the producer produced the record.
Right.
And say I'm going to love the artist. I'm going to wait till I hear and see what the artist is about. Even though Jermaine produced it, I still want to see what it's about. So I want people to do the same thing with Jante. I want people to like Jante for Jante and then listen to the music and then say, damn, and JD produced it. This is a perfect album. You know what I mean? So that's how it is with Jante. I'm really excited about his project, though.
Yeah, man, we all excited, you know. And one thing I will say on this, though, Jermaine, is that, you know, when we look at album credits, you know, and like I said, I go back to the 80s, so I'm sure you may know what I mean by this. You know, it used to be a time we used to be able to buy 12 inches. We used to just look at the label, and we wouldn't know one name from the other. We'd see Def Jam, we'd see, you know, 4th and Broadway, whatever. We just buy the record because we trusted it. And your production has got to that point now where folks just trust it. And one of the biggest reasons why, man, is because you don't sell us out. And what I mean by that is that not so much that you won't make a song that crosses over, but you make soulful songs that cross over. You know what I mean? Some folks out here target the pop chart. I mean, that's where they're going. Your songs are R&B songs or hip hop songs or whatever with real substance that just happen to make it over and shoot up to number one, which is unusual, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, see, my theory with that is that I believe that urban music that we love is the records that's pop, that become popular records. You know what I'm saying? Like if you listen to, like, Lil Wayne and Baby new record, Stun Like My Daddy, that's a hood-loved record.
Right.
And then the hood made the suits that are made the dudes that's in corporate America like the song. So then the corporate America dudes, they start loving Stun Like My Daddy because they got a friend that's in the hood that loved it. So they start liking it, and they start playing it, and they like it, and then it transcends to white America and the pop America out there where they be like, yo, I seen this dude over here, IBM, talking about Stun Like My Daddy, and then I was in Brooklyn, and, you know what I'm saying, I was out there at the bodega, and I heard somebody ride by playing. So it just, and that's always my theory. Like, if I go wrong with the streets or the hood, then I'm off center from that point all the way down. Because I can't gauge what pop music is. Like, since I came into this business, you know, the definition of pop music has always been scattered to me because Criss Cross had a number one record. You know what I mean? So, and I know when I made Jump that I wasn't sitting around saying this is going to be a top 100 number one record. You know what I'm saying? I was just happy to get heard. I made the beat, and I made the beat the way I made it, and I was just like, you know, hopefully the hood, all the kids in the streets like it, and these little kids love it. But I was never even thinking about, you know, being on the same charts with Bruce Springsteen and other people like that. So that's always been, I just stick to the stuff that always kept me afloat. If I pay attention to my fan base every time, as long as they love it, I believe that other crowd can come right in. You know what I'm saying? That pop crowd, they'll come in. They'll because they love what we like.
Right.
And then what we love, they just go way over the top with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, for real, like Hammer. Like, we loved MC Hammer in the beginning. MC Hammer was the most hood you could possibly be.
Right.
And then whatever we love, they going to take it through the roof. I'm telling you. If you pay attention to any record that we have ever loved, Michael Jackson, the biggest black artist ever, the biggest black band, the Jackson 5, the black kids of America, they loved them.
Right.
They loved Michael Jackson. That was he was our superstar. He was our big dude. Was like, oh, they got somebody they love. Oh, we can really get part of this. You know what I'm saying? That's how I always visualize it. It's just like pop America, they don't want to miss that, the love that we have, because it's such a beautiful thing once we finally fall and click into loving a record or music, period.
And with that said, I want to extend on that and ask you a question. Do you think that black spending power, or not even the spending power, black influence is underestimated by corporate America?
And very much so.
And what tells you that? I just want to get your opinion on that.
Because it's last to be thought about. Like, if black America spending money was thought about in the beginning of a corporate meeting at some of these big companies, it would be so many other brothers and sisters with jobs. But the fact that it's last to be thought of, and then it's so minute of a thinking pattern that, you know, you could tell from the job just how people get jobs and how it works. Because there's so many kids out here that could just let you know about things. You know what I'm saying? It's just like in the urban world, we it's a must for us to be hip. We don't just do it to be doing it. Where in other worlds, I don't know what other worlds it is, but I know the urban world. In other worlds, people just get computers or something. Say, let's use a computer. People will buy a computer just so they can say, I got a computer at my house, and it works, and they'll learn how to do it. Where we want that shit computer. Well, we want that computer that Jermaine Dupri got at his studio. So I was looking in the Source magazine, and I seen Jermaine in the back. He got a Mac.
Right.
And I don't want no Dell. I don't want no, you know what I'm saying? I don't even want no PC. I heard JD say on the record that a PC meant poor man computer. Like, just that influence, you know what I'm saying? Just, and we don't, and when we say stuff, we don't even know what we're saying. You know what I'm saying? We just make stuff up. Like that PC around my studio, that's what we call PCs. But if I said it to you and people hear me say it, then it might kill their sales. They don't even realize that.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? It's going to kill their sales, and people going to be like, well, JD said he used a Mac. There's so many kids that want to know what I do to make records, and they'll go out and buy Macs all day long because that's the one that they think is hip. That's urban spending power. And that's real power where they can read it in print and go do it. Much less, don't let them see me using it. Then it's really bad. You know what I'm saying? It's just like I was telling somebody the other day about this kid, Nigo, from Tokyo. Like, he got a pair of sneakers that cost $10 to make. And kids in New York and everywhere else around the world is breaking their neck to buy these shoes, and he's selling them for $200. Right. Now, half of the reason is because me, Pharrell, Kanye, and everybody else put these sneakers on. And if you ask him, he'll tell you he know what the urban spending power is. You know what I'm saying? And the same thing with, it's all these companies. If they paid attention to it from the beginning, then, you know, they will see a lot different things going on in their life. I mean, they definitely make a lot more money than what they're making.
Right.
I mean, they already feel like they're making a lot of money, so it's not really like, it don't seem like they should spend the money on that extra yard to go, but they just don't realize it. And the urban culture is not something that you pass by. You can't just ride down the street and see what's going on in the hood. You got to have somebody physically show you, or you gotta live it. And that's the only way. Like, what we do, if you ain't living it, you ain't going to really know what's going on.
That's right. And I was asking that for a reason, because, you know, just watching the economic empowerment that we give to corporations. I mean, I'm going to give you a couple examples. Big rims, 20s, 22s, 24s. I never seen a commercial for that shit. Them motherfuckers is flying off the shelf.
Yeah.
And they ain't cheap. You know what I'm saying? Diamonds. It's you know, we put the branding on certain companies that, number one, won't market to us, don't care to market to us, and they're reaping the rewards, because when they see it in the video, when they hear it in the song, and the kids grab onto it, and we add that hip factor, as you were talking about, somebody's shit takes off.
Well, see, Nike is one. Phil Knight knows the power of the urban spin because he signs all the urban players that come out. You know, since Michael Jordan showed him what he needed to do with his money, and since then, you know, he's done right. I mean, Phil Knight is one of the dudes that I can say physically did right. He don't candy coat it. If you go in Nike Town, if you go in Nike Town, it looked just like the dudes wanted to look. You know what I'm saying? What's his name? LeBron James signed with Nike, and he wanted to put out his own Air Force One and call it a hater and do it. And he wanted to compete with these Bathing Apes, and Nike made it. You know what I'm saying? They made it a limited edition, but they made it. And they also know, Nike knows that their biggest selling sneaker is Air Force One.
That's right.
It's not that Air Force One sneaker. They put the sneaker out for 6 months, then they take it back, and then they put it out again. And they know every time they put it out how quickly they flying off the shelves and how many people buying them by the 10s, 11s, and 12s just to have these sneakers. They know exactly what's going on. And that's the thing, like, other people should really, really investigate and have a real survey in life so they can really see. But with Phil Knight, he had the proof. He had Michael Jordan. You see Michael Jordan as a hood icon. If you go to the hood, it's every kid in America got a pair of Jordans on. And, you know what I'm saying? And this is supposed to be a place where we can't afford nothing.
Man, you know, it's funny. I had a conversation with Meth on an interview, and we were just going down the list, the name and names of, you know, artists and producers that are challenged now to try to figure out, you know, the key word these days is relevance. You know, who's relevant and who's not, you know, and it's almost shameful. Fuck that. I always do anyway. I point the blame at Black Radio to a certain degree because of the bottleneck that's going on, and also at the labels, you know, just because of the way, again, there's so much music that's out there, but it's not necessarily able to be all channeled and heard from all the different outlets that are out there. And, you know, our media outlets are very limited. I mean, now, you know, you are, again, one of the icons of black music. How much media time do you truly get? You know, when you think about it, you've got BET. I'm sure you've been on, you know, MTV and VH1. But how much runtime do you really get versus, say, you know, other genres of music? Because you don't get a chance for people to get to grow and know you. And it's one of the reasons why I do the show, because you guys have so much to say. Artists, producers, etc., have so much more to say than just listen to my last hit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, you know, what's your take on people? I mean, because Janet, you know, I mean, you know, from my era and on up, Janet is one of the icons of just culture itself. And right now, that question of relevance is something I heard brought up one day about Janet and her material and et cetera. And this is shameful to me. I just want to get your take on that.
Well, I mean, like I said, it's still, you know, this business is still, it's still very much ran by those older people. You know what I'm saying? And the older people that's running the business, they still think, they still got a mindset of thinking the old ways, but they listening to younger people in some kind of aspect. And when they listen to the younger people, they hear the wrong shit, basically. And what they hearing is relevant. That's what they listening to. They hear somebody say, oh, that's not relevant. And they looking for the quick way out, too. You know what I mean? You got to understand that. They looking for the quickest way for them to make more money than spend money. An artist like Janet, you got to spend money on her to make the money that you want to make on her. An artist like, just say any artist, like, just make up somebody like Tiffany that just came out that's like 16 and she got a hit record. You could spend $10 on her and she might give you $100,000. Well, with Janet, you got to spend $100,000 to get to $1 million. You know what I'm saying? So right. That's the game that they playing right now. It's not really about, it ain't really about relevance. It ain't really about, it's a money situation. That whole relevant thing is really like hogwash to me, because I brought back Mariah Carey, who was basically an artist that the whole music industry has shit on. And she had a flop movie. She had signed to Virgin Records, which is the same record company.
Right.
They put out an album that was Glitter that didn't do nothing. They dropped her and they gave her $25 million to leave. And she went to a place that understands how to make music.
Right.
And a man that understands what you're supposed to do with an artist that's the statue of Mariah Carey. And then they came to me as a producer, and they came to Pharrell, and they went to everybody else, and they made an album that was worth listening to, and Mariah Carey sang the way she always sang, and this one man put this album out, and he put out a record, and he made sure that he shot the right videos, and he spent the right money on promotion, and he made sure she was everywhere and put her in the places that she should be in to make her relevant. You know, because relevant, the word is it's a bigger word than what it actually is. To be relevant is just to be in the spotlight and to be in people's face.
Right.
You make yourself unrelevant by not going out to clubs and not being in places where you're supposed to be. And I don't think unrelevant is a word. But at the same time, that's, you know, you understand, you get the point. If you ain't on Johnny on the Spot and you ain't got nobody telling you, like, yo, tonight you should be at this Mary J. Blige album release party, let people see your face, let da 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 da. I mean, you still got to work. You know what I'm saying? Artists get a little, like, beside themselves and don't realize that they still, that's work. You know what I'm saying? Go out to the club, let somebody see you, show your face. You coming out with a record in the next 3 months, let people ask you what you're doing. What I'm doing right now, this is work. This ain't like, you know what I'm saying? It's fun for me to talk. I don't even personally really like talking about myself, though, but at the same time, I know that it's people out there that want to hear this. It's people that want to hear what I'm doing, and this keeps me relevant. You know what I'm saying? This right here keeps me relevant. And if I do this and do two or three things more like this, then more than the next person, then Jermaine Dupri is a more relevant producer than this producer that's over here. Like, that's what I'm saying. So it's like, it really don't have nothing to do with the artist. It's about, are you going to lay it out? Are you going to lay out a roadmap for the artist to be relevant? Or are you going to let the artist are you going to let the artist drown in what they did already? Because, like, even right now, nobody has put out a record bigger than Jump in the last 6 years. Right. But Jump, right now, me telling you or telling kids, y'all made Crisscross Jump, it don't mean shit to nobody. Right. You know what I'm saying? They don't care. They want to know, how did I make Confessions? And you know what I'm saying? What you do with Mariah when she was in the studio? They don't care about Crisscross Jump. And that was more, that was youthful. That was the most youthful. Them kids was 12 years old. But that just go to show you how quick things get old. And what you did in the past really don't matter no more to nobody. So that's pretty much what it is.
Yeah. What was the situation with Virgin? Because, you know, there's a lot of rumors around that.
I really don't. I mean, you know, personally, I don't know what's going on with Virgin as a whole. I quit, though, as president, basically. And that's pretty much my story. On the rest, on the other end, you know, Janet has a deal with them. And I believe that Janet's deal is up with Virgin. You know, you got to understand, I was just a president. What people don't realize is that it's chairman. There's so many other people that's above a president. You know what I'm saying? That's over the top of president. Even the president only have the authority to spend money when he wants to. And that's just how, you know, that's the president of the United States, too. You know, it's still somebody that's the treasurer.
Right.
That's over the cheese. You know what I'm saying? President just can't go take the money. He got to go through so many different channels to get the money. He is the person that creates the excitement to start it. But it's still so many other people out there that have to end up making that decision. It's certain things the president can't do, and it's certain things the president can't do. And when it came to Janet Records, there was a lot of things that needed to be done that the president couldn't do. And that's why I basically called myself saying, I mean, you know, basically quitting, because it got out of my hands. I did everything that I could possibly do to get everybody started. Like, you know, I gave Janet a number one record with Call On Me, where people, Janet, she ain't had a number one record in 6 years.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So when you talk about relevant, then when that happened, people don't want to pay no attention to it. You know what I'm saying? People want to still ignore that. They don't want to pay no attention to it. But I'm saying, damn, like, you know how hard it is to get a number one record? Like, this ain't easy. Especially not in today's world where everything's got to be relevant, and they playing Janet Jackson on the radio.
Right.
She got a number one record, so she not relevant. You know what I'm saying? It just got to a point where, you know, when bullshit is, you know, when you can smell bullshit.
I mean, I'm sure that's a frustrating process, you know, as far as being, you know, the executive and the professional that you are, and knowing that you've got a record that potentially could be a cash cow if they just work the record, you know, and have your hands tied.
It's so many politics in the music business, you know what I'm saying? And that's another thing. Like, I didn't get in the music business for politics. I got in the music business to make music and for people to hear my records. And, you know, for the most part, when it's a whole lot of politics, I'm really not the person to be around all that, because I don't really, you know, at the end of the day, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, personally, this was the first time I ever had a job, too. You know what I mean? You got to work. You got to realize that I've been a CEO of my own company forever.
Right.
So for me to work for somebody, I always was the person that was against that from day one. Like, when I was 16, I told myself, I'm never getting a job. By the time I turned 21, my mom kept saying, you know, you got to move out, get out on your own. So I kept saying 16 to 21, I got like 4 or 5 years. I got to get this together. That's why I was so intrigued into making sure my music got out there. I would never go out. I stayed in the house all the time. I was just determined to make it happen, and that was my whole motivation, is that I never wanted to work for nobody. I saw my homeboys working at McDonald's, and now my dude that worked at McDonald's is Skeeter Rock. He worked. He's an A&R at So-So Def and Virgin. And I told him, I went and got him one day from McDonald's, and he was like 23. He was probably like, because he always like 2 or 3 years older than me. So he was like, he wasn't 20 yet, but he was probably like 19, and I was like 16. I went and got him, and I told him, like, dog, you ain't got to do this no more. I promise you. And you know, since then, he ain't had to work for nobody but besides me. And, you know, that ain't really like working for nobody.
Well, man, I'm gonna tell you, you know, prior to you coming into Virgin, you know, folks used to say, you know, Virgin was the graveyard for black music. I mean, until you showed up and you changed a lot of things around. I hope that they miss you. And as far as, you know, black music goes, man, we'll follow your ass as long as you ain't working for the KKK. We gonna ride with you.
This is an exclusive idea. Black Music Month interview. The Lost Bio.
What can I do when my best ain't enough? I just throw my hands up like what? There's nothing I can do about it. It's out of my hands. So I just pray about it. I don't know the plan.